Hi, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour from the Bear Cave. I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, we have an article written by Andrew Larson. It's titled, Sikorsky to Lay Off Hundreds After United States Army Cancels Development of Scout Aircraft Program. Stratford-based Sikorsky Aircraft will lay off hundreds of employees as a result of the U.S. Army's recent decision to cancel its Future Attack Reconnaissance Aircraft, or FARA, program. A spokesperson for Lockheed Martin said the company is reducing less than 1% of its positions within its Sikorsky business segment. Lockheed Martin has about 122,000 employees worldwide, according to its website. We intend to retain as many roles as possible to meet national security commitments and preserve the U.S. rotary wing industrial base, the spokesperson said. Lockheed Martin did not provide an exact number of jobs eliminated. The reductions are across Sikorsky's U.S. locations, which include its main plant and offices in Stratford, along with facilities in Trumbull, Shelton, and Bridgeport, and in other states including Texas, Florida, and Alabama. The Army began the FARA program, which involved developing a next-generation scout aircraft in 2018. 2 years later, it picked up designs by Textron's Bell and Sikorsky, according to Reuters. Sikorsky's X-2 aircraft, which offered speed, range, and agility that no other helicopter in the world can match, was designed for the program. In February, the Army dropped the program after spending $2 billion on it, according to Reuters. The Army said that after a sober assessment of the modern battlefield, it would instead increase investment in uncrewed aircraft, Reuters reported. An April 15th article in Vertical magazine called the Army's cancellation of the program very upsetting for many in the industry. The bottom line is that this is a very disruptive event for the companies involved, Mike Hirschberg, director of strategy at the Vertical Flight Society, told the magazine, saying they've had to put in hundreds of millions of dollars and they've hired hundreds of people for this program. Some of these employees moved across the country to take the jobs. Now each company has to try and find other work for those who were working in the FARA program or lay them off. Julia Bergman, a spokeswoman for Governor Ned Lamont, said the governor spoke with Sikorsky President Paul Lemo on Monday evening. While this news is unfortunate, the company remains committed to Connecticut and will continue to be an important contributor to the state's manufacturing and defense sector, Bergman said. He added, the administration has spoken with senior Army officials who have expressed continued and increased support for the Black Hawk program. Bergman said the administration expects the laid-off workers will be quickly and easily absorbed into the state's manufacturing ecosystem, as there is high demand for engineers and technology workers in Connecticut. She said the state is working to connect them with new opportunities. Sikorsky lost another major defense contract in late 2022 when the Army selected Bell to build a long-range assault aircraft that would replace some Black Hawk helicopters. But Army officials have said they're planning a multi-year contract for the procurement of the UH-60M Black Hawk, which is produced by Sikorsky. This deeply sad news should also be a call to action to aid the workers and communities most directly impacted, but also to enhance investment in our defense workforce, U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal said, adding, Sikorsky's engineers are among the very best in the world, and my office stands ready to do whatever we can to help all the workers who are affected by this deeply disappointing decision. These men and women are desperately needed throughout the defense industrial base, and I am confident their skills are critical to maintaining our national security. U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro, whose district includes Stratford, also released a statement about the cuts, saying, "Sikorsky and its employees are the lifeblood of our community, and I will continue to do all I can to ensure the company has the resources to remain competitive and continue to create good-paying jobs in Connecticut." Next up, an article written by Michael Puffer titled, "Windsor Locks Restaurant Building Sells for $1 million. A pair of South Windsor investors have paid $1 million for a Windsor Locks restaurant building hosting a Dunkin' location, then sold a separate Dunkin' location in Windsor. In a deed recorded March 6, Cargo Connecticut Properties LLC, whose principals are James Coughlin and Megan Ostick, bought a 2,730-square-foot fast-food building on a half-acre located at 596 Elm Street in Windsor Locks from George Sispoitis of Windsor Locks. The building was completed in 2000, according to town records. Coughlin and Ostick share a South Windsor residence, according to state business records. In a separate transaction that occurred later in March, Cogco Connecticut Properties sold an 1,891-square-foot condominium unit in a Windsor retail strip to a buyer from Florida. That unit hosted a Dunkin' location. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini is titled, "Physical Therapy Owner Buys Former Milford Bank Building for Relocation and Expansion." The owner of a physical therapy and sports medicine facility has purchased a former bank building in Milford where he plans to relocate and grow his practice. Keith and Glenn Steigbegel, principals of BB295 LLC, bought the property at 295 Boston Post Road for $1.25 million from Milford Bank in a deal recorded April 11th. Dr. Keith Steigbegel is the owner and operator of Prolete Physical Therapy and Sports Medicine, which has locations in Woodbridge and Milford. Steigbegel says he plans to relocate his current Milford office at 247 Broad Street to the newly purchased building by the end of the year. The new facility will include a 3,000-square-foot gym for wellness activities. With the move, Steigbegel says he plans to expand physical therapy and wellness services, allowing Prolete to take on more patients and staff. Milford Bank opened that branch in 2010, but announced plans in mid-2023 to close it by the end of last year. It still occupies its main office at 33 Broad Street, as well as additional branches within the city. Advances in banking technology have eliminated the need for consumers to visit a nearby branch for most day-to-day transactions, company executives said at the time of the closure announcement. The bank purchased the 295 Boston Post Road property in 2009 for $750,000, according to city records. The 5,100-square-foot building dates back to 1955 and had an appraised value of $1.3 million as of 2021, according to city records. Mike Riccatelli of Orange-based Colonial Properties represented the seller in the deal. Next, an article written by David Krzyzewski is titled, "Cigna Group Foundation Commits $27 Million in an Effort to Support Mental Health and Health Equity." The Cigna Group Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the Cigna Group, said on Thursday it plans to invest more than $27 million in grants to support nonprofits that focus on mental health and health equity. The Bloomfield-based insurer said its foundation initiative will partner with nonprofits with expertise in three areas: improving youth mental health, bolstering veteran mental health through housing stability and services, and addressing barriers to health equity. To do this, the foundation said it will allocate more than $27 million in grants to nonprofit organizations over the next 3 years. The Cigna Group Foundation has a proud history of helping improve local communities through high-performing partnerships with nonprofit organizations, said Melissa Scottgard, Foundation Board Chair. She added, "Our society is only just beginning to recognize the scale of the mental health crisis for young people coming out of the pandemic, and our company is committed to doing our part to address these challenges that affect so many of us." The grant program will address post-pandemic stress and distress among 5 to 18-year-olds, with a first-year focus on programs and services delivered in schools and related settings, the foundation said. It has opened the application process for organizations in select states and encourages nonprofits that specialize in supporting youth mental health and well-being to apply. Applications will be accepted through May 22nd. The foundation said it will prioritize grants in regions where the Cigna Group serves a significant number of customers with high and very high social determinant of health risk, including Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Missouri, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Texas, as well as in targeted international communities. The foundation will also look to provide grants to nonprofit organizations with expertise in the following areas: improving the mental health of military veterans through housing stability and home ownership with support services, and reducing barriers to health equity through the newly formed the Cigna Health Group Equity Impact Fund, which will launch later this year in targeted areas with significant social determinants of health that put the community's health and vitality most at risk, it said. Later this year, the foundation will open applications for nonprofits focusing on veteran housing and reducing health disparities in communities, it said. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by David Krzyzewski. It's titled, "West Hartford Approves Four-Building, 322-Apartment Complex on Part of the Former UConn Site." After a five-hour public hearing and another hour of discussion on Monday night, the West Hartford Town Council granted final approval to a controversial four-building, 322-unit apartment complex on Troutbrook Drive and Asylum Avenue. The council voted 8-1 to approve the project, which will transform a massive parking lot across the street from a former University of Connecticut branch campus, over the objections of a majority of about 50 residents who attended the meeting, including one who threatened a lawsuit. The application by WEHA Development Group East LLC, which owns the 23.78-acre property at 1700 Asylum Avenue, sought approval for a zone change for 14.9 acres of the northern portion of the lot from the existing R10 single-family zone to an RMMS multifamily multi-story residence district zone with a special development district, or SDD, overlay. The property includes not only the massive parking lot, but also three baseball fields for the town's youth league and the West Hartford Miracle League, which provides opportunities for children with physical disabilities or cognitive challenges to play baseball. The project will retain the ball fields and add a 100-car parking lot on about 9 acres of the southern portion of the lot. The applicant was represented during the public hearing by attorney Robin Pearson of Alter & Pearson LLC in Glastonbury, as well as by Matthew Brutton, a principal with Meriden-based BL Companies, an architectural and engineering firm, also traffic engineer Robert Batramatis, and Michael Lawson, a principal with Minow and Wasco, a New Jersey-based architectural and planning firm. Also in attendance was Eli Pechtold, a principal with Stamford-based Garden Homes Management Corporation, which is under contract to own and operate the apartment complex. According to the presentation by the applicant, the plan is to erect 4 buildings with a total of 322 apartment units, including 115 single-bedroom units and 207 two-bedroom units. 26 of the units will be designated as affordable housing. Buildings A and B will contain 72 units. Building C will have 42 units, while Building D will have 113 units and house the main lobby and a clubhouse. Each of the buildings is 5 stories high, though the 5th floor is set back 30 feet to lessen the impact of the height of the buildings compared to the surrounding neighborhood of single-family homes. A total of 558 parking spaces will be created, or about 1.75 spaces per unit, which is more than the minimum requirement of 1.5 per unit. The total also significantly reduces the amount of paved area from what exists now. In discussing the 700-page traffic study report he submitted, Batramatis drew a laugh by stating that the project will not have a significant impact on traffic in the area. He defended the report, stating that traffic study is an objective science. Pearson also defended the study, saying a study done for a similar project in the area was found to be entirely accurate by a follow-up study. The project also will extend sidewalks along Trout Brook Drive and add a community green and walking trails through the property, which will be open to the public. The plan also will preserve a massive white oak tree, the largest of its kind in the state, as well as add other trees and plantings. It received approval from the Inland Wetlands and Watercourse Agency in January. The idea here is to really enhance the meadow quality of the site, Lawson said, adding, "We think of this as an extra amenity to the residents who will call this place home." Pearson noted that the applicant had made many, many changes to the plans to address concerns raised by town officials and abutting property owners, and noted that both the Town Planning and Zoning Commission and Design Review Advisory Committee had provided letters stating the appropriateness of the design for this location. A majority of the residents who attended the public hearing disagreed with that assessment, with many stating the project is too large for the neighborhood and raising traffic and safety concerns. That included Christopher Hennigan, who owns a home on Asylum Avenue, and presented the council with a 10-page petition signed by abutting property owners demanding the project be rejected. If certified, the petition also would require a supermajority of the council to vote to approve the project. The council allowed Hennigan to collect additional signatures during the hearing. "We are prepared to take legal action if the project is approved," he added. Following the hearing, during the council's special meeting, Corporation Counsel Dallas Dodge said the town clerk and town planner had worked during the public hearing to verify that the petition signers all owned property within 500 feet of the site and that all owners of each property had signed as required by the town charter. Dodge said 34 lots were represented by signatures on the petition, or 13.2% of the abutting property owners, but that only 29 of those lots, or 11%, had signatures of all owners. He said that did not meet the 20% required by the town charter, so a supermajority vote was not necessary. Another speaker who objected to the project during the public hearing was Mike Michaud, executive director of the Miracle League of Connecticut. He said the plan to create 100 parking spaces was not nearly enough for the baseball complex, given the number of players who participate, and especially when special events that attract a large crowd are considered. Pearson said the developers had conversations with the University of St. Joseph, which abuts the property, about the possibility of providing parking and shuttle bus services for such events. University President Rona Free attended the meeting and spoke in support of the application. Deputy Mayor Ben Winograd summed up the majority of the council's position on the project, stating that he believed this is a very strong plan with a benefit to the town as a whole. He cited the affordable housing, the estimated $1.6 million in annual tax revenue, and the improvements to controlling and treating stormwater runoff, among other benefits. Mayor Sherry Cantor agreed, noting that one-third of the property is dedicated to recreational and green spaces. This is private property that the public is being invited to walk on, she said, adding it's a very good use of providing homes where a parking lot once stood. The lone dissenting vote was cast by council member Mary Fay, who said simply that the project does not fit. This is very much a single-family neighborhood, she said. This is too big. Come back with a three-story and I'd probably say yes, but this is too big for the site and I'm really concerned about the Miracle League. This council concluded by approving the application with a dozen conditions. The 1700 Asylum Avenue project is the first piece of the redevelopment plan for the former site of the UConn branch and UConn School of Law. The site has been vacant since 2017 when the school relocated to Hartford. An initial proposal to create a mixed-use development on the 1800 Asylum Avenue parcel was withdrawn from the Inland Wetlands and Watercourse Agency in December. A new plan has not yet been submitted. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Michael Puffer titled, LLC tied to Torrington construction firm O&G Industries pays $1.37 million for Avon office. A limited liability company tied to Torrington-based construction services firm O&G Industries recently paid $1.37 million for an 11,416-square-foot office building in Avon. Shap Delane Enterprises LLC sold the 1977 vintage brick building on 4 acres at 40 Darling Drive to Darling Drive Associates LLC in a deed recorded March 12th. The seller's principal is Paul R. Shap Delane of Newport, Rhode Island. Shap Delane is also president of RMI Corporation, a business management software company that lists the Avon building as its headquarters. Attempts to reach RMI were unsuccessful. Darling Drive Associates shares a Torrington address with O&G Industries. Its principal, Matthew Oniglia, is property manager for O&G. Attempts to reach Oniglia were not immediately successful. Next up, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini is titled, Second Street USA Coming to Downtown New Haven. Yale has secured a national fashion retailer to take over space in the Shops at Yale, formerly occupied by L.L. Bean. Second Street USA, a player in the resale, secondhand, and sustainable fashion retail market, has signed a long-term lease for 7,600 square feet on two floors at 272 Elm Street in downtown New Haven, Yale officials said on Tuesday. This will be Second Street's first Connecticut location, which is expected to open in August, according to the school, which owns the Shops at Yale. L.L. Bean closed its downtown New Haven store in February. David DelVecchio, Director of Real Estate Asset Management for Yale University Properties, said the space was fully built and well-maintained with lots of interest from prospective tenants. Second Street has locations in New York City, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, and DelVecchio said he expects the New Haven location to draw consumers from around Connecticut and surrounding states. Sustainable fashion is one of the fastest-growing markets, and Second Street USA is one of the industry leaders. They will bring value and eco-conscious options to downtown New Haven, which will appeal to our student population, New Haven residents, and those living in the surrounding towns, DelVecchio said. Next, from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Greg Bordenaro. It's titled, Downtown Hartford Office Building Targeted for Redevelopment is Listed for Sale. A New Haven landlord that appears to be selling off his downtown Hartford buildings has put another Center City property up for sale. The 35,277-square-foot office and education building at 275 Asylum Street has been listed for sale by the Lisa Kazi team with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services New England. The asking price is $4.89 million. The property has sat vacant for years and was previously used by Hartford Public Schools as a high school, High School Incorporated. It is currently owned by New Haven-based Ocean Management and its principal, Shmuel Eisenberg, who bought it in 2021 for $3.915 million, records show. When Eisenberg purchased the property, which sits diagonally across the street from the XL Center, there was speculation that he would convert it to apartments, but no redevelopment has occurred. The property has had several liens placed on it by the city for delinquent property taxes and the MDC for unpaid water bills, land records show. According to the listing, the former high school site stands primed for transformation, boasting approved plans for a residential complex featuring 50 units, including a mix of studio and one-bedroom apartments. Eisenberg's Ocean Management firm recently sold off another downtown Hartford property located at 201 and Ucello Street, an apartment building known as the Grand on Ann. That 26-unit apartment building sold in late February for $3.9 million to Ann Ucello Apartments, LLC, whose principal is Quay Wallace Watkins of Stamford. Ocean Management originally bought that property in 2021 for $3.15 million. While Ocean Management also owns a pair of Hartford Church properties, the former St. Augustine and St. Peter's School buildings, located at 20 Clifford Street and 11 Charter Oak Place, respectively. The company purchased the properties in 2021 for $3.75 million, with plans to potentially convert one or both to apartments. Liens have been placed on both of those properties by the city and MDC for unpaid taxes and water bills, land records show. No conversions have taken place thus far. Ocean Management has been selling off various New Haven apartment buildings in recent years and has faced various liens and other issues with properties in that city as well. We're now going to jump to the Thursday, April 18th, New York Times business section, starting off with our business news roundup, the DealBook newsletter. First article in the newsletter, Congress ramps up the pressure on TikTok. The push to either split TikTok from its Chinese owner ByteDance or ban it in the United States is gaining momentum thanks to a legislative maneuver by the House Speaker, Mike Johnson. The bill's progress comes as The Times reveals more details about the video platform's origin story and the central role played by the Chinese subsidiary of the trading firm of a Republican donor, Jeff Yass. Johnson has bundled the TikTok bill into a foreign aid package. The speaker said on Wednesday that he would put up for a vote this weekend a spending measure for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that includes a modified version of the TikTok divestment legislation. The move may force the Senate's hand. The House overwhelmingly passed the bill last month, but the Senate has not been in a rush to take it up. Bundling the TikTok measure with aid to Ukraine could force the upper chamber to act. The move to package TikTok is definitely unusual, but it could succeed, Paul Gallant, a policy analyst for the financial services firm TD Cowen, told The Times. That won't please ByteDance investors, a group that includes major American financial firms, including General Atlantic and Sequoia Capital. Another is Susquehanna International Group, the firm founded by Yass that owns a roughly 15% stake that is worth billions on paper. The Times' Mara Hvistendahl and DealBook's Lauren Hirsch detail the role that Susquehanna's Chinese subsidiary SIG China played in ByteDance's birth. SIG China helped steer the career of Zhang Yiming, the ByteDance founder. It made him the CEO of 99Fang, an online real estate platform, in 2009 and backed his effort to create a social media company in 2012. A Susquehanna director in China would write years later that the housing site deal led to the birth of ByteDance. And a SIG China staffer gave Susquehanna an early look at ByteDance's precursor. An investment memo described a prototype application created by Zhang that selected content for users to engineer virality and increase stickiness. It added social network technology will be used to track user behavior, predict user interest, and build relevancy and recommendation engines. The document surfaced in a Pennsylvania lawsuit in which former Susquehanna contractors accused the firm of taking search technology to ByteDance without compensation. A spokesman for Susquehanna told The Times that these claims are without merit and we will defend ourselves vigorously. So what's next? The Senate could vote on the foreign aid package, including the TikTok bill, as soon as next week. But opposition against the move is not going away. Yass has financed a group pushing against the ban, and Chinese diplomats are reportedly lobbying Capitol Hill staffers. Some short stories and what's happening in the business world. Microsoft may avoid an antitrust challenge to its OpenAI deal. The European Union won't open a formal investigation into the $13 billion investment because it does not amount to a full takeover of the ChatGPT parent or give Microsoft control over the startup's future, according to Bloomberg. The deal still faces scrutiny from British and American antitrust regulators. Next, Google fires 28 workers after sit-ins protesting a contract with Israel. The dismissals came after dozens of employees took part in demonstrations against Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion deal shared with Amazon to provide the Israeli government with cloud computing services. It's the latest sign of deepening tension between Google employees and management over work for Israel in the light of the war in Gaza. And the NBA bars Jante Porter over betting. The league found that the Toronto Raptors forward had tipped bettors about his health, limited participation in at least one game to control bets on his play, and bet on NBA games while he was in a lesser league. Porter is the first active player or coach to be expelled for gambling since 1954 and is a reminder of the risks that sports leagues are taking as they embrace betting. Next article in the Business News Roundup, the long road ahead for Musk's mega payout. Tesla got investors and critics talking on Wednesday after it asked shareholders to vote again on a $47 billion payout for Elon Musk that a Delaware judge had rejected because of how it was devised. But while the proposal stirred up debate about the richest payday in the history of corporate America, there are still a lot of steps that need to be taken before Musk finally gets that money, if he ever does. A reminder of what's happening. Investors are being asked to re-approve the stock grant, which was overwhelmingly ratified in 2018 after Chancellor Kathleen McCormick of Delaware said that Tesla's board was too cozy with Musk. The plan always required Musk to meet a series of rising financial performance hurdles, which he did. The vote, along with more disclosure about how the package was created, is meant to address that criticism. It seems probable that the plan will be approved again. Four of Tesla's 10 biggest shareholders, including T. Rowe Price, said they supported it. We believe the 2018 plan demonstrated strong alignment with the interest of long-term investors, and it was followed by an impressive, validating period of value creation, the mutual fund giant said. Thousands of individual investors also voiced their support to the board and on X, Musk's social network. But Tesla must also successfully appeal McCormick's decision. Until then, the package is still voided under Delaware law. Moreover, that appeal process will not begin until after a July 8th hearing on the fee request by the lawyers for the shareholders who challenged the compensation package. They've asked for $6 billion worth of Tesla stock. In the meantime, investors have other things to be concerned about. Tesla is set to report first quarter earnings next week, and analysts and investors do not have high hopes. The company has already said that sales fell sharply in the period, its first quarter-on-quarter drop since 2020, and announced that it was laying off 10% of its employees. Barclays on Wednesday cut its price target for Tesla's stock by 20% to $180. It closed at $155.45. That goes toward the central question that the vote on Musk's pay represents. Is he still the right person to lead Tesla? He has already threatened to turn his attention to his other companies if he isn't given more voting control. But some investors and analysts are questioning his focus on cutting prices and on autonomous driving. This vote is the test that investors get to say which way they want to go, Roger McNamee, a tech investor, said on CNBC. Next, AI is running out of power. The artificial intelligence boom isn't slowing down, with the Taiwanese chip giant TSMC saying this morning that demand for its processors was insatiable. But powering that activity may prove to be a big challenge, and tech executives are increasingly warning that electricity supplies need a boost. AI requires huge amounts of electricity. The International Energy Agency estimated that global energy demand tied to the technology will more than double by 2026, and power grids are not equipped to deal with that shift. Spending could surpass $225 billion this year alone, according to Digital Infra, a research group. Analysts at Bank of America say power consumption by United States data centers will double in the next 3 to 5 years. Tech giants are spending big on energy infrastructure, including nuclear and solar power. Andy Jassy, Amazon's CEO, emphasized the company's AI focus in his annual letter to investors last week. But he has warned that there's not enough energy right now to power new generative AI services. Amazon says it's in regular contact with U.S. officials about the power grid. AI could also spur a geographic shift for tech. Virginia is a hub for data centers, but there will be growing pressure to find sites elsewhere as power supply gets strained there. Bank of America analysts expect more data centers to be built alongside renewable energy plants in less congested areas such as the central and southeastern United States, where power capacity is underutilized and power prices are lower. Next up from the Business Roundup, supply chain detours for the Baltimore Bridge. 3 weeks after the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge forced the closure of Baltimore's port, America's supply chain industry is figuring out how to deal with the loss of a major hub for getting goods in, out, and around the country. Railways, truckers, and shipping companies have found workarounds up and down the East Coast in an effort to avoid the kinds of snarls seen in 2021 and 2022. Other ports, including the Port of New York, and New Jersey, are picking up some of the slack for cars, overseas goods, and more. But as the Times' Peter Evis reports, the disruption is still causing a lot of pain. The trucking industry is under immense stress, with executives saying they are struggling to get drivers and loads to where they are needed on time and without losing money. Akram Ayed, owner of 410 Transport, a Maryland trucking company, said that his costs had shot up because he now had to transport cargo farther to the Port of New York and New Jersey instead of Baltimore, and that his customers were balking at having to pay more. "We're dying here," he said. To finish out this segment, I'm going to jump back to a few short stories from this week's Hartford Business Journal. First up, Michael Puffer says Massachusetts investors pay $1.8 million for Rocky Hill Warehouse. A Massachusetts investor recently paid $1.8 million for a nearly 20,000 square foot warehouse in Rocky Hill, and the site has already been leased to a construction contractor. In a deed recorded April 4th, Phoenix Rocky Hill LLC sold the 1986 vintage masonry construction warehouse on 2.1 acres at 71 Hammer Mill Road to 71 Hammer Mill Road LLC. The seller's principal, Michael Panic of Oxford, is also principal of Southbury-based Phoenix Realty Management. The limited liability company is tied to Paul Richardson and his Burlington, Massachusetts-based Bostonian Properties. Richardson, on Monday, said his company owns and manages more than 365,000 square feet of commercial properties with tenants including GE, Vernova, Federal Express, and Pfizer. And David Kershevsky writes, Greenwich-based biotech venture capital fund launches with $500 million. Regeneron Ventures, a Greenwich-based biotech venture capital fund, announced on Monday it has launched with a five-year, $500 million commitment from its exclusive limited partner, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Regeneron Ventures will be managed by former Regeneron Pharmaceuticals executives Dr. Michael Aberman and Dr. Jay Markowitz. The fund will focus on promising biopharmaceutical healthcare and health technology companies, it said. Regeneron Pharmaceuticals has committed $100 million annually for 5 years to the venture. Understanding that the most groundbreaking, transformative approaches to preventing and treating disease may yet to be discovered, the fund will invest for the long term, agnostic to therapeutic area, technology, and stage of development, Markowitz said. Both Markowitz and Aberman began their professional careers in medicine before switching to investing and operational roles in biotech. Our goal is to cultivate an ecosystem where the next generation of biotech companies can thrive, drawing on the lessons learned and successes achieved at Regeneron and throughout our careers, Aberman said, adding, "Together we will strive to identify and support groundbreaking advancements that push the boundaries of what's possible in science and medicine." We'll now move back to the Thursday, April 18th, New York Times business section with an article written by Nicholas Nahamas and Jim Tankersley titled, "Biden, Competing with Trump to Be Tough on China, Calls for Steel Tariffs." President Biden on Wednesday called for major increases to some tariffs on steel and aluminum products from China, speaking to members of a national steelworkers union in Pittsburgh as he vies with former President Donald Trump for votes in northern industrial states. "These are strategic and targeted actions that are going to protect American workers and ensure fair competition," Mr. Biden told a crowd of about 100 union members at the United Steelworkers, which endorsed him last month. "Meanwhile, my predecessor and the MAGA Republicans want across-the-board tariffs on all imports from all countries that could badly hurt American consumers," Biden said. The Biden administration has argued that a flood of low-cost exports from China is undermining American-made products, jeopardizing Mr. Biden's push to expand U.S. manufacturing, a central focus of his economic agenda. In his speech, Mr. Biden said he would ask the U.S. Trade Representative, Katherine Tai, to increase tariffs to what White House officials said would be 25% on certain Chinese products that now face tariffs of 7.5% or none at all, pending the outcome of an administration review of the China tariffs initially imposed under Mr. Trump. "I want fair competition with China, not conflict," Mr. Biden said, flanked by supporters and signs that read, "President Joe Biden standing with workers." "And we are in a stronger competition to win the economic competition of the 21st century with China or anyone else because we are investing in America and American workers again." The move is another effort by Mr. Biden to put up new barriers to trade with China in some industries. It could help him compete with Mr. Trump in a tough-on-China context with swing voters, though administration officials said elections did not motivate the move. A day earlier, Mr. Biden began a 3-day swing through Pennsylvania, a crucial battleground state, by giving a speech in Scranton in which he focused on the tax code but repeatedly attacked Mr. Trump and accused him of favoring billionaires over the working class. Mr. Biden's plans on Chinese trade are more targeted than Mr. Trump's, though. The former president has called for sweeping and steep new tariffs on imports from China and elsewhere in a potential effort to fracture trade lines between the countries. Mr. Biden's administration is reviewing existing tariffs and is expected to propose raising some rates on Chinese products while reducing others. At a morning stop for breakfast on his way to Pittsburgh from Scranton, Mr. Biden was asked by reporters if he was worried about a trade war with China. "No trade war," he replied. Before Mr. Biden's remarks, Ms. Tai announced that her office had begun an investigation into China's aggressive support for shipbuilders and other related industries in response to a union complaint. "The American commercial shipbuilding industry is a shell of its former self," the unions wrote in a filing with the trade representative. They added, "The biggest obstacle to the industry's recovery is the unfair trade practices of the world's largest shipbuilding nation, China." In the complaint, the unions cite hundreds of billions of dollars in Chinese government support for the shipbuilding industry. Those include supplying steel from government-owned companies at below-market rates, along with a variety of efforts to steer low-cost loans and other financing to shipbuilders from state-run companies. Ms. Tai called the allegations serious and concerning. The moves threaten to deepen a trade dispute with Beijing, which has criticized Mr. Biden for his own efforts to subsidize American manufacturing, including tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act that are meant to increase production of solar panels, electric vehicles, and other technologies aimed at reducing fossil fuel emissions. China's Commerce Ministry sharply criticized the investigation in a release, saying it was filled with a large number of false accusations, misinterpreting normal trade and investment activities as harming U.S. national security and corporate interests, and blaming China for its own industrial problems. In his speech, Mr. Biden also reaffirmed his support for the Steelworkers Union in a dispute over the proposed sale of the Pittsburgh-based U.S. Steel to Nippon Steel of Japan. Nippon officials have vowed to invest billions in American manufacturing facilities to keep U.S. Steel's headquarters in Pittsburgh and to honor existing labor contracts. But the attempted purchase has drawn fire from the union and a bipartisan group of senators, largely from industrial states, who say it could compromise national security. Mr. Biden has signaled opposition to the deal, which his administration is scrutinizing on security and antitrust grounds. He has said repeatedly that he will stand with steelworkers in the dispute over the sale, though administration officials have not specified exactly what that means in policy terms. In Pittsburgh, the president appeared to promise a worker that he would not allow the company to leave the United States, a move that no one is discussing currently. "Let's keep U.S. Steel in America," one woman told Mr. Biden as he met with steelworkers before his speech. In his speech in Pittsburgh, Mr. Biden did take a veiled swipe at Mr. Trump, referring to him as "my predecessor, who's busy right now." The crowd laughed, seeming to get the joke about Mr. Trump's whereabouts, although the former president does not actually have to appear in courts on Wednesdays, at least not yet. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Neil Boudet is titled "VW Workers in Tennessee Start a Vote on UAW Testing Union Ambitions." Last fall, the United Automobile Workers Union won big pay increases from the Detroit automakers, and the impact rippled quickly through the non-union auto plants scattered across the South. Afterward, Toyota, Honda, Volkswagen, Nissan, Hyundai, and Tesla raised wages for their own hourly workers in the United States, none of whom are unionized. On production lines in Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, and elsewhere, those pay increases have been referred to as the UAW bump. Now, 4,300 workers at Volkswagen's plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, will test whether the union can achieve an even greater bump. On Wednesday, they began voting on whether to join the UAW, and the prospects of a union victory appear high. About 70% of the workers pledged to vote yes before the union asked for a vote, according to the UAW. "I think our chances are excellent," said 48-year-old Kelsey Smith, who has worked in the VW's plant's paint department for a year and is a member of a committee working to build support for the UAW. "The energy is high. I think we're going to nail it," Smith said. Volkswagen has presented reasons it believes a union is not needed at the plant, including pay that is above average for the Chattanooga region. But it has also said it encourages all workers to vote in the election, which is to conclude on Friday, and decide for themselves. "No one will lose their job for voting for or against the union," a company spokesman said. The stakes go beyond the Tennessee plant, Volkswagen's only U.S. factory. A victory there would add fuel to the UAW's push to extend its presence to the more than two dozen non-union auto plants in the United States, mostly clustered in southern states where union resistance has been strong historically and where right-to-work laws make it hard for unions to organize workers. The UAW's chances beyond the Volkswagen factory are unclear. Japanese and South Korean automakers have demonstrated more forceful opposition to the UAW than the German companies. Tesla's chief executive, Elon Musk, has spoken out against the UAW on several occasions over the last few years. And on Tuesday, the Republican governors in six states, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, denounced the UAW drive, saying in a statement that they were highly concerned about the unionization campaign driven by misinformation and scare tactics that the UAW has brought into our states. We have worked tirelessly on behalf of our constituents to bring good-paying jobs to our states, the governors declared, adding these jobs have become part of the fabric of the automotive manufacturing industry. Unionization would certainly put our state's jobs in jeopardy. The vote at VW will be followed by another election, as yet unscheduled, at a Mercedes-Benz plant in Vance, Alabama, where the UAW says a majority of workers have signed up to back the union. The UAW says victories at VW, Mercedes, and other plants would bring increased wages, richer benefits, and higher living standards for tens of thousands of workers, many of them in the nation's poorer counties. Widespread unionizing in the southern plants would also help level a playing field that, for nearly half a century, has been tilted against the three unionized Detroit manufacturers, General Motors, Ford Motor, and Stellantis, the parent of Chrysler. In operating non-union factories, foreign-owned companies have a significant labor cost advantage over their U.S.-based rivals. It would be a revolution for the UAW and for the auto industry, said Harley Shaken, a professor emeritus at the University of California in Berkeley, who has followed the UAW for more than three decades. It would break the glass ceiling for the unions in the South and would mean more purchasing power for working class people in that region. In the last 10 years, the UAW also lost in a 2017 vote at a Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi, and an organizing drive at the Mercedes plant fizzled without an election. If Ford can pay that much, why can't Volkswagen pay us the same? Said 40-year-old Isaac Meadows, a father of six, who has worked at the VW plant for 14 months, saying, "We have more worth than they are paying us." There are concerns beyond the hourly wage. Workers must use paid time off if they want to be paid during two periods when the plant shuts down around the year-end holidays and in summer. Once he covers the shutdowns with vacation days, Mr. Meadows said, he is left with about 16 hours of paid time off to cover any family events or sick days for the rest of the year. "I miss my kids' dances, sporting events, family gatherings," he said. "I miss a lot because I've got to work." Well, you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour. From that bear cave, I'm that Barry Slater. So thank you for listening. Have a great day, and thank you for letting me give you the business.